Well, let's go ahead and pray, and we'll get everybody in and settled. Heavenly Father, thank you for your kindness to us and for your power and your blessing. And I pray that you would help us as a church to honor you, to be faithful to you. Lord, to be wise in our conduct, to be not only diligent students of your word, but obedient to it, to submit ourselves to it. And to pray that you would help us now in all of our public services, Father, as we unpack your word and explore it, that you would, in the power of your Holy Spirit, teach it to us. You are its author and the understander of it. Help us, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen. So my intention had been, well, actually my intention was to spend about 3 weeks on ethical issues, because that was about how much I could come up with, and obviously this has gone into many, many months now. And I keep thinking that I'm about done. And this is not in any way a criticism, okay? And then, you know, people will say, well, what about this or what about that? And I'm just always happy to have that. And quite honestly, I had not given one microsecond of thought to this subject. And somebody said, are you going to say anything about gambling? And so I thought, oh, I perhaps ought to say something about gambling. So now, if you have anything left with that you think would fit under this umbrella, if you would convey that to me immediately. I think I know what I'm going to do next week, which would be the 19th. And then the 26th, of course, is... these are the things that I kind of think of. You know, Bill Smith will be here. He won't be doing the adult Sunday school, but that's VBS kickoff. I don't know what we'll do. And then when that's over, I don't know, we may go into something else. There were some other things that were put on the list when I surveyed you about a year ago of interest, and so we may work through them. But anyway, this morning, our subject matter... I want to do this. Guys, I'm passing around. Jared, can I start that with you? The next men's prayer meeting sign-up sheet, it goes through the end of August. So if you want to pray during one of the public services, morning or evening, if you would sign up for that, I would appreciate that. And again, I'm not trying to be snarky, but, you know, I just found for me and the way I think and everything I do on Sunday, if you sign up, I'm going to, you know, communicate with you about that. And if nobody signs up, I'm just going to pray. So rather than, because, you know, I have some guys, and I appreciate it. You say, you know, anytime, but... You know, it's not anything about you, it's just me. You know, on Sunday, you know, my brain is in full ADHD mode, and, you know, I just, that kind of stuff falls through the cracks. So I generally think about it as I get to the platform. Oh, you've got to get somebody. So, all right, so anyway, ethics and the Christian. So what about gambling? Well, what about gambling? Let's start by talking about what gambling is not. Just to kind of sweep a few things out of the way. And I'm going to do that on two kind of levels, one culturally and one biblically, I guess. What gambling is not is just taking a risk. Okay? In other words, to take a risk is not to be a gambler. Proverbs 27:1, boast not thyself of tomorrow, for thou knowest not what tomorrow brings forth. Nobody knows the future. This is one of the... right from a human standpoint, this is one of the great challenges of being a human being. If I knew, right? And I don't just mean, you know, if I knew what stock was going to increase 10%. I just mean if I knew, right? If I knew that this decision was going to, you know, bounce through these ways, that would impact certainly the way I live. God knows that I don't. So every day is a risk to that extent, you know. So just to place yourself or to be aware of the fact that you have put something at risk does not constitute you a gambler. In fact, I would point out that we manage risk through wise and reasonable processes. Okay, and you know, this is something that perhaps we could have a conversation about, you know. Insurance is risk management, right? I pay Prudential a small fee every month in exchange for which, if I die tomorrow, they will pay my wife a substantial amount of money. I am offsetting my risk. I am paying a fee, but a relatively modest fee, in the chance that I die. Prudential is managing the risk as well, right? I mean, these are the kind of things that actuaries do, is they calculate the statistics for 58-year-old guys. How long will he live? Does he do crazy things like jump out of airplanes? Does he smoke? Does he fly an airplane? You know, what are the chances that he's going to die in the next 24? If you have a private pilot's license, quite a bit when it comes to your life insurance. Yeah. What does it have to do with it? Well, obviously you're not an actuary. I think that you could make the case that... I think within the realm of private pilots, I don't know that that would hold true. Not to mention the fact that, you know, here's the problem. Private crashes, airplane crashes, are generally fatal. You know, it would take a significant amount of airbag to now non-bursting bubble wrap, now that they've repackaged it too. So, interest rates is risk management. There was for a while, I don't know if you saw it, there was a commercial that came on television, and it was a very attractive young woman who was magnifying her Indian heritage by wearing, you know, Indian attire, and she was very rapidly selling you, you know, that you could get cash now. You could get cash in 12 hours or 24 hours if you needed it. And, you know, it was actually being run by the Cherokee Nation. And the interest rate was 800% on your money. And then the government very quickly stepped in, and you don't see that ad anymore. But, yeah, you know, you could borrow, like, you know, $8,000, and you could have it tomorrow. And then your payments would be, you know, like $200 a month for the rest of your life, plus, you know, a significant share of your grandchildren or something like that. But I mean, it really was. And it was all there in the fine print, you know, and then you could, you know, my point is this, without getting really off track. This is one of the ways that we manage risk, right? This is why everybody is trying to sell you on your credit score and is concerned about what your credit score is, because this is a way that we manage risk. How much can I trust you? How reliable are you? These are the kind of things that credit scores reveal. And so my point, folks, is just this. The world in which we live is one in which risk is recognized on a wide-scale basis, and people who are involved in it, either specifically and deliberately, like insurance companies, or just people like us, right? The prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, Solomon said. And, you know, life contains uncertainties, and to negotiate those uncertainties does not inherently make you a gambler, okay? Business ownership, whether it would be total or fractional, in other words, like investing, you know, some people say, well, you invest in the stock market, it's just like gambling. No, it really isn't. It's risk, but business ownership, which is what investing in the stock market is on a fractional basis, is not gambling. I mean, it's not gambling in any way. I was going to say, you know, I'm trying to think through myself. If you were just stupid, right? I mean, if you just, you know, type some numbers into Google and came up with the ticker symbol of a company and bought 1,000 shares of that without knowing anything about them, would that constitute gambling? No, I think that would constitute stupidity, but not necessarily gambling. So business ownership, whether it's total, you own your own business like my wife does, or fractional, you own a few shares of the Ford Motor Company, for instance, that's business ownership. And you're investing, by the way, if you do that well, you're investing in people who understand risk management and do it pretty well. That would be my, okay, so. Gambling, what gambling is not, what is gambling? Gambling is involving a game, that's why it's called gaming. that involves a random chance, and no amount of participation or experience can substantially reduce the risk. This is how we would define gambling. No amount of experience can substantially reduce the risk. You could sit at the slot machine 8 hours a day for 20 years. It wouldn't change the odds one bit. You have no control over that. That's gambling. You have committed yourself to a random chance. And, you know, I know that somebody probably is sitting out there thinking, well, yeah, but, you know, maybe blackjack is a little different, and maybe blackjack is a little bit different. You know, some of the card games involve some amount of skill, but we'll get into that in a moment. We're still doing the same kind of thing. Sitting at a card table 8 hours a day, you know, 5 days a week for 20 years does not give you any leg up on the way the cards will be dealt. I mean, you just have no control over that. So gambling is a game that involves random chance. No amount of participation or experience can substantially reduce the risk. So that's culturally. So, you know, I don't think a guy who is in business is a gambler. I would hope not, because my wife owns her own business. And we don't think of that as gambling. And, you know, we manage risk, you know, with things like car insurance, which is mandatory, and life insurance, which is not. And property casualty insurance, which is not mandatory, but I'm guessing most of us have. We also manage risk, right, by exercising and through our diet and wearing seatbelts, you know, those that do, those kinds of things. Okay, so now let's move into biblical, because casting lots is not gambling. So let's get our Bibles out and let's look at this. Okay, we have casting lots is biblical. My argument and contention is that casting lots is not gambling. This is one of the questions that usually comes up. Well, is casting lots gambling? Which, you know, we inaccurately, but, you know, on the right track, you know, we would associate with throwing dice. It involved two different colors, stones, and, you know, picking out a stone. But here it is. I mean, this is, okay, Leviticus chapter 16 and verse number 8. This is on the Day of Atonement, right on or about 10 October every year. Aaron shall cast lots upon the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other for the scapegoat. And, of course, if the lot fell on the Lord's goat, it got sacrificed, and the scapegoat, you know, got all of the sins of Israel confessed over it and cut loose in the wilderness. So there is casting lots. Okay? And it's not mentioned a lot in the Bible, but it's mentioned some. There's a New Testament reference, Acts chapter 1. Acts chapter 1 and verse number 15. And in those days Peter stood up in the midst of the disciples and said, the number of the names together were about 120, men and brethren, this scripture must needs have been fulfilled, which the Holy Ghost by the mouth of David spake before concerning Judas, which was guide to them that took Jesus, for he was numbered with us and obtained part of this ministry. Now this man purchased a field with the reward of iniquity, and falling headlong, he burst asunder in the midst, and all his bowels gushed out. And it was known unto all the dwellers at Jerusalem, insomuch as that field is called in their proper tongue Ekeldama, which is to say the field of blood. For it is written in the book of Psalms, let his habitation be desolate, let no man dwell therein, and his bishopric let another take. Wherefore, of these men which have accompanied with us all the time that the Lord Jesus went in and out among us, beginning from the baptism of John, unto that same day that he was taken up from us, must one be ordained to be a witness with us of his resurrection. And they appointed two, Joseph called Barsabbas, who was surnamed Justus, and Matthias. And they prayed and said, Thou, Lord, which knowest the hearts of all men, show whether of these two thou hast chosen, that he may take part of this ministry and apostleship from which Judas by transgression fell, that he might go to his own place. And they gave forth their lots, and the lot fell upon Matthias, and he was numbered with the 11 apostles. And, you know, there's a lot of speculation about whether or not that in and of itself was legitimate, but I would point out that Peter was endeavoring to honor the scriptures, let his bishopric let another take, and he was numbered with the 11, and so anyway, we go on from there. But there you have casting of lots. Proverbs 16:33, the lot is cast into the lap, but the disposing thereof is of the Lord. The lot is cast into the lap, but the disposing thereof is of the Lord. Why is cast? So, I mean, we're talking basically something about, folks, about something that appears to be a random choice, right? We got a group of people. They have, let's just say, one black rock, one white rock, and everybody's going to cast one color rock, and when they get all done, they have more black rocks for Matthias, right? I mean, it's kind of like a heads or tails. Heads Matthias, tails the other guy. The lot is cast into the lap, into the folds of the robe. The disposing thereof is of the Lord. How is this not gambling? How is this not gambling? And there are three distinctions that you need to understand why this is not gambling. Okay? Number one, nobody's risking anything. Nobody's risking anything. Number two, nobody's gaining anything. There's no transaction here. And number three, this was all ultimately committed to the Lord. I mean, this was the whole point, was that we recognize the sovereignty of God in the outcome. And so, how is this not gambling? Well, we're risking nothing and we're gaining nothing, and we're looking to the Lord for his leadership and his decision, which leads me then. So what gambling is not, it's not taking a risk or exposing yourself to a risk, and it's certainly not casting lots. What is wrong with gambling for money? What is wrong with gambling for money? And I would put it that way because I fully acknowledge and even have at times participated in friendly games of poker. And, you know, when I got saved, our pastor was absolute, hands down, death on playing cards. I grew up playing cards. And then we got saved, and our pastor was totally opposed to playing cards. And I really don't remember, but I mean, you know, he had a whole history of it. You know, I think, you know, the jokers were demons, and you know, there was a whole history to it. And for many, many years, we just did not play cards at all. Now, part of a larger conversation, and maybe what we'll take up next, what I'm really contemplating taking up next week, is putting all of that kind of stuff, all of this kind of thing into its own little world of picture and the way in which we relate. But anyway, I grew up playing cards. And so I'm making a distinction, and you can say, well, you're defending yourself. Well, no, I don't play cards that much, and I certainly don't play poker that much. But you know, what's wrong with gambling for money? What's wrong with gambling for money? Okay, I would make a couple of observations here. Number one, it is contrary to God's plan for obtaining wealth. Wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished. Now, the question really is that a legitimate application of the verse? In other words, when Solomon said, wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished, did he mean gamblers are going to lose? And I would say, I don't think that's primarily what he was getting at. That his argument was that futile means of making money. Okay, I mean, you know, there are, in other words, there are no doubt some really wealthy people who have made their living by gambling. And that money has not been diminished. Solomon said, wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished. There are, on the other hand, people who have worked hard and made a living and their money is all gone. That doesn't mean their money is made by vanity. But I think the principle can carry over there, but I think there's a lot more to it. In other words, if the only thing that I could argue against gambling was Proverbs 13:11, it would be a very weak argument indeed. And unfortunately, in the world in which we live, even strong arguments are rejected by many believers these days. People just want to do what they want to do. It is contrary to God's plan for obtaining wealth. I think that we could develop this, but again, we're stretching the application, and I admit that, in the parable of the talents. Which really is not about your economic productivity, but about your spiritual productivity. That's the primary agenda there. So supposing you said to somebody, they said, well, what about, why do you Christians hate gambling? And you said, well, wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished. And they said, but I make my living as a gambler. That is my job. So it's not like I'm not trying to work. I work as a professional gambler. And there are professional gamblers in the world. I make my living as a professional gambler. I would argue that this still poses serious problems within the Christian mindset and worldview. Number one, how would you as a believer reconcile in your mind doing something that by definition is called a game of chance while standing solidly on the pillar of I believe in a God who controls all things? I mean, it seems to me that stretches us pretty extremely to try and cling tenaciously to both of those worlds. Second question I would ask, and I think this goes well beyond just our conversation about gambling, but how do we, folks, defend ourselves doing anything that has as one of its pillars of success deception? And I mean, if you're going to be a good gambler, right, we even have a nice word for it, right? We call it the bluff. How do we as Christians defend, right, anything that involves deception? Thou shalt not bear false witness, if you think about it, is way more comprehensive than don't tell a lie. Thou shalt bear false witness squeezes over into territory of manipulating in truth the truth in such a way that not all of the truth gets told. I mean, this poses challenges to lie. To me, this is one of the great obstacles that one faces in giving oneself over to politics as a profession. Politicians who tell the truth, generally speaking, don't fare well. Have you noticed that? They are not particularly popular.
The military uses deception.
Yeah, I know.
And even battles in difficult, in a lot of times, they
well, use deception. I'm gonna argue that, you know, that in the midst of a military war, in a national security kind of situation, where, you know, In the situation of just war, as Augustine called it, I would concede that the rules are going to be somewhat different, right? I would admit that. I'm not saying that it's any less. I mean, and in some ways, I'm not arguing that it's, you know, this is one of the beauties that God has from his position of strength, is that he never needs to try and fake anybody out, right? I mean, you know, we talk about this. I mean, biblically, God's position has always been, you get as strong as you want, build as big as you want, do as much as you want, and that's what I'm going for because I'm going to show you that I'm God. I'm not like that. So, you know, you go back to World War II, right? I mean, you know, the only American general that the Germans really feared was George Patton. So what do we do with Patton and D-Day? We make a big charade out of George Patton. Right, we give him a fake army, a non-existent army. We send him on non-existent training exercises. The Germans are staring at him. We're trying to fake him out. I would admit that's somewhat different than I'm going to pay my house payment by lying to you, John. Right? As a professional gambler, I'm going to make my house payment by trying to get your money.
Right. I think the difference is monetary.
Yeah.
I mean, because almost everything, even hunting, there's the deception in making a fake goose call. I mean, there's tons of deception.
Hey, don't touch. Don't say the word fish. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't go there. We have to convene a church disciplinary committee meeting. Don't use the word lure. Don't say that. Jen?
But just about all sales, everything in sales.
Well, I'm going to argue, is there not a difference between marketing and deception? I mean, I think there really is. Well, you know, I guess I would say this. If I'm selling something personally, okay, like I've been selling some stuff on eBay. I try to tell the absolute brutal, honest, total truth. I'm selling it. Here it is. This is what I know about it. This is how it works. This is what's wrong with it. Take pictures of the flaws. You know, personally, I think I have that kind of an ethical obligation. You know, I understand that if I'm buying a lawnmower, you know, I kind of understand that if I stick my fingers under the deck of it running, that it's going to chop off. I don't, you know, I wouldn't count Toro or Honda as deceitful if they don't say, this is a great mower, but it will sever your limbs. You know, I mean, you know, or, yeah.
Talk about everybody knows, like, a car dealer is known for selling all the good points and kind of leaving out there.
Well, I would say to anybody, you know, who is knowingly selling a defective product, right? I mean, this is where, you know, you go back in American history, this is where you got to go back to Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and the whole introduction of the Pure Food Act and the Federal Trade Commission. I mean, these are you know, we have entire multi-billion dollar government agencies, right, ostensibly whose job is to ensure that when Kellogg's, for instance, sells you a product and says 100% natural, that it is, in fact, 100% natural.
Absolutely.
Right?
So they're not renewing that, by the way. It's time to back up. Congress did not pass, so you can get meat products now, as of now, without labeling on what content.
I don't know.
Yeah. I'm just saying that there's, you know, I understand that marketing, a guy's trying to sell me something, I understand that. You know, so I get, you know, I'm not saying that necessarily that guy's off the hook. I'm just saying that, you know, if I walk into a car dealership to buy X brand, you know, whatever that car salesman tells me, you know, I'm looking beyond him to that manufacturer to make sure that he has sold me a good and legitimate product. If I buy a used car, right? I mean, this is why reputation does matter, because I'm relying upon. Yeah, well, but I mean, you know, I just don't think that marketing, and I'm not a big marketing, you know, I'm not a big fan of marketing, okay, in general, and everything that goes with it. Although my son-in-law has a degree in marketing, so, you know, I mean, But I don't know that necessarily trying to sell me something by saying it will do, you know, I would say it's only deceptive if you say to me it will do A, B, C, and D, and it will in fact not do that. I don't necessarily count you deceptive if you say to me it'll do A, B, C, and D.
Don't mention that it won't do C,
K, and F. Yeah. I mean, I have some obligation there to probe and ask questions. So, David.
I would just say there's people in the audience right now that would know more about this than I do, but the whole American economy is built on marketing things we don't need,
right,
but buy anyway. the entire economy?
Well, there you go. Now, there's an interesting question, Dave. I mean, Dave raises it that we're, you know, the whole economy is built around primarily selling the stuff that we don't need.
So when we go into a car dealership, I've got a 2,000 Pontiac Bonneville that gets me to work, and I don't care what it looks like.
Well, you guys are just out to get me today, aren't you? I mean, first fishing, now cars. I mean, what is this? Is, you guys have a business meeting?
My point, though, is that if I walked into a dealership and they said, I got a really nice car for you, and I say, I want that car, but I can't afford it, they're going to figure out how to help
you. They're going to figure out how to help you afford it.
I'm going to walk out, and the whole thing, the whole time, whether it's the cereal that we produce or the Fritos that I used to make, and Frito tried to tell people that Fritos were nutritionally good for you, and got laughed out of the market. This is like 30 years ago. They just tried something, a marketing tactic that didn't work. But the whole thing is, whether I'm buying cereal or buying a car, it's like you stuff it up, you decide whether you want to eat it, buy it, whatever, and then you walk away.
Man, the whole fact that we live in a consumer world, and we do as Americans, that's a whole other subject in and of itself, isn't it?
Well, I guess so marketing isn't lying to you. They're appealing to things that they think that are going to appeal
to you. Well, that's maybe it's another ethical decision. To what extent am I allowed to appeal to your lust?
To the full extent, because God expects us to have control of our... The fact that we watch TV means we're going to expose ourselves constantly to things.
Maybe we should do one on the ethics of owning a television.
There's something simple there.
I haven't, you know what, you got to, there's a couple of guys, John, you have to go after. I haven't watched a NASCAR race in a couple of years, really.
So I got a couple of questions about gambling.
Okay. Yeah, fire away, gambling.
So in time past, I haven't done it since I got to Kellogg. It's just kind of gone by the wayside. So I used to do a pop on a football game because you guys knew that I like football or a specific team. And they'd say, well, we'd put a pop on it. We'd agree that, well, it's just a pop, and I buy the pop anyway. Is that improper? Because I'd stop doing it right.
Okay, so are two guys betting over a soda pop on the outcome of a football game? Is it wrong? Okay, somebody tell me. How many of you would absolutely under no circumstance, come on folks, we're church, right? How many of you under no circumstances would you do that? Well, there's about three hands raised. All right. I will throw one out to you. Periodically, when we go on the Canada fishing trip, particularly when it's late at night or on a rainy afternoon, we'll break out a bag of M&Ms, divide them out, use the M&Ms as chips, and play poker.
That's awesome.
That's what? Oh, I thought you said that's awful. I was going to say, well, nobody eats the M&Ms after they've been passed around after they've been passed around for 3 or 4 days. But
I go out immediately. So
that's what I say. You know, I mean, I recognize that my hands are not lily pure in this. I mean, does that violate the spirit of trying? I'm going to come back and argue that it's certainly not violating the spirit of what I'm at here. You know, I'm talking about, you know, and I realize it's kind of dicey. You know, well, what if I just want to take $100 a month and go over to the casino and burn it up? Is that a problem? I think there are some real cautions there, and I'm going to get to that in a moment. Is that as morally reprehensible as, you know, I'm going to try and make my living by doing this? I don't know. I mean...
So here's my next question for you. We had a card counter at work.
Yeah.
And he worked for me. And over a period of time, he established that he had good days and bad days.
Yeah.
What he does is he gambles his own money until he's sure he's having a good...
Right.
And card counting is a science all of its own. And he could do it.
Yes. I have a brother-in-law that could do it. Card counting.
So he controlled himself entirely. He'd stay there between 2 and 4 hours. He would be unobtrusive. Casinos would not notice him, and then he would say, if I'm having a good day and you give me $50, I know I can turn it into $150. Is that wrong?
Is it wrong? I would not be comfortable with it, and let me work through my list here of some additional considerations to bring into this picture. Okay. Here would be one of my things. I think to do this, you know, to gamble for money, whether it's that kind of scenario, and there are some people, right? I mean, you know, like any other activity, you know, there are people who are going to excel and they rarely excel for no apparent reason, right? So I just think that this kind of conduct brings us into potential, if not real conflict, with some very serious Bible principles, okay? So this would just be some of my assessment, all right? Leviticus 19:18, thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am the Lord. Okay? To what extent does my hoping to gain at your loss violate that principle? And there is no gambling for money in which that is not some part of the consideration. Right? I mean, if we just said, let's have a Westwood Heights Baptist lottery. Right? It's just church people. Right? Everybody, you know, everybody buy a ticket for $10, and let's just say we sold, you know, 1,000 tickets, we got $10,000, the church is going to keep the tithe, and we're going to give $9,000 to the lucky winner whose name we pull out of a hat. Okay? Everybody has experienced some degree of loss so that one can gain. And I realize that in things like lotteries, which, by the way, have a long history in America, I mean, a long, long history, you know, from a political standpoint, one of the beauties of the lottery is that nobody is compelled. I mean, right? You know, the government to this point has yet to compel us to buy lottery tickets. We do it purely voluntarily. So I'm just throwing this out. You know, so, you know, I'm sitting at a card table across from a guy, and if I win, he loses, and if he wins, I lose. But we're both volunteers. So have I violated the spirit of love thy neighbor as thyself? I don't know. I'm just wondering how that kind of thing would affect me. Could I live with myself in the knowledge that I'm profiting at your expense? I just think that's part of the equation, okay? And in every form of gambling, the losers pay the winners. And, you know, again, you would make the argument that in every form of gambling, the losers are volunteering to lose and deliberately putting their money at risk. Letter B, 1 Corinthians 4:2, and again, this is not the specific application that Paul has in mind. He's talking about something far larger than that, but it is, moreover, brethren, it is required in stewards that a man be found faithful. I am a steward of that which God has given to me. And quite honestly, you know, I'm not particularly sure that one of the conversations I want to have with God is, you know, that I was, you know, hoping to parlay $100 into $200 by, you know, winning a game of chance. You know, and look, folks, you know what? Here's one of the things when we get into these kind of ethical issues, right? I mean, have you noticed that we haven't had any ethical Sunday school lesson on stealing? Because you either steal or you don't, right? I mean, it's like marital fidelity. You either are or you're not. There's not an ethical kind of marshland here where we can probe this or probe this. We're all kind of exploring the boundaries of this. And probably 30 years ago, a prominent pastor wrote an article in reference to, you know, some guy who hit the jackpot big in the lottery, you know, and was going to give some money to the church, you know, and he said, I would not knowingly take that money, and he went through the whole thing on that. So we're all, you know, so one church is going, yay, the mortgage is paid, and this guy's going, we will never knowingly take the winnings from gambling. So to go back to this, Matthew 10:29, which is a reference to not only God knows the sparrows, but none of them fall without him, which doesn't mean that he saw, oh, that sparrow fell. What it means is he kills sparrows. I mean, God manages his universe to that degree of detail, was the point Jesus was making. You know, we would take it even smaller than a sparrow. You know, God manages the universe to the range of the atoms, you know, and the neutrons. It is his universe. So God is sovereign over small things. Do my involvement in a game of chance pay that proper respect? And I just, those are things I would have to consider. Romans chapter 7 and verse number 7. Paul was talking about the wonder, the beauty of the law, the goodness of the law. And he said, I had not known lust, except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. And Paul didn't mean he wouldn't know what it was to have a desire. He would, but what Paul is arguing is he wouldn't have had any way to rightly relate himself to his desires if he didn't have a law that said, you can't covet. So that brings you, you know, so now what do you do with a guy who is a very regimented, disciplined, you know, I take X amount of dollars, and, you know, when it's gone, it's gone. You know, has he managed his lust? Maybe in some ways he has managed his lust better than I would, or that I have in other areas. I'm just throwing these out as moral considerations. Can I really gamble without stirring up lust? And, yes, sir. You mean to have a job?
Yes, because you're working to get more. You're not working to get less.
Well, biblically, we're not necessarily working to get more. Biblically, we're working to get enough. And so I think that, yes. Yeah, Chris, you could certainly, I could certainly turn my work world into a venue for my lust. Right. Well, they are, but they still fall all under that umbrella of a random game of chance. Now, certainly some of those games have more ability, like counting the cards.
But if you're going back, I mean, where are we drawing the line here? Are we drawing with chance? Are we drawing with gaming? Where's the violation? Is the violation because we're playing a game?
Well, I think that's part of the great question and part of the exploration. What is the violation? And is there only one violation? And is there only one violation?
I mean, you're taking a risk at work, regardless of, I mean, no matter how you word it, you're still taking the risk at work. You're risking that your job's going to be there tomorrow. You're risking all kinds of stuff. So is it the gaming that's the problem? If it's the gaming that's the problem, and you're making a living out of it, it's not really a game, and that would make other gaming wrong. I mean, I guess I'm not clear on where we're drawing our line here.
Well, I don't know where I'm drawing, though. I mean, you know, for me, I don't. Well, that's a good question, too.
You can't say that I'm gambling M&Ms, and so that makes it okay. I'm not. I'm just saying that's still a value. It may be a small value, but it's still a value. So are we defining it through risk, or are we defining it through the amount?
I guess I would define it through the hope of gain, of substantial gain.
There's always a hope of gain.
Right, and I'm not arguing that there's anything wrong necessarily with. Right, we work for gain. I mean, we biblically we work for enough. I mean, there is a real fine line there, Chris. Right? I mean, I don't think God is not fundamentally opposed to any of us being wealthy. He is absolutely positively opposed to any of us having the multiplication of wealth as our end, whether that be at the poker table or whether that be at the boardroom table. Right? They that will be rich fall into a snare. I mean, Paul is very clear about that. 1 Corinthians 6. When I get out of bed in the morning and I go, my primary objective today is to make money and to make more money than I had. And a good year is that I made more money than I made last year. And this is the measurement of my life. And this is how I value myself. I am in biblical trouble, 1 Timothy 6. Well, you were here a long time. How many times did you hear me condemn gambling?
I counted 4.
It's not something that I would do. It is something that, you know, at that level would make me relatively uncomfortable. You know, we had a couple that visited a few years ago, and, you know, Leafy and I went by to see them, and you know, I hadn't said anything. You know, they'd been here on the Sunday morning, and we went by to see them, and they said, we both work at the casino. We just kind of looked at each other and went, well, it was nice to have met you. They knew, we knew. I mean, it wasn't going to be a great fit for us. And part of the issue here with this is like this here. You know, is there any way to gamble without inciting lust? I don't know. You know, maybe a guy can go, yeah. You know, there are things for me that I would avoid simply because, you know, and I mean, I'm being really stupid here, but I'm just being stupid to make the point. I mean, you know, I have said to the church, I have, you know, I have this conversation with my wife. You know, there are some foods, right? For me, a cookie is the drug of choice. I don't want one. I want all of them. And for me, it is an all or nothing. It just is. I don't eat one.
But don't you think that's the key?
Yeah, I think a lot of that is the key. So, I mean, that's, but, you know, I mean, look, you know, so we're having the conversation. How many of you would absolutely positively, under no circumstances, wager a can of pop on the outcome of a game? A couple of people wouldn't do it. Everybody else is looking at me. You know? I mean, I think we all recognize that there are boundaries here. You know, we don't post deacons over by the casino to see if anybody's driving in. But on the other hand, every time I go to Bass, you know, every time I go to Bass Pro Shops, I go, I hope nobody sees me driving to Bass Pro Shops, because it's like winding through Casino Alley to get to them. I think, oh, this is great. Somebody's going to snap a picture of me with a casino in the background. And I'm just trying to buy something to lie to a fish, okay? I mean, that's all, you know, to deceive the fish. That's all I'm, I don't want, you know. Ann, you had, go ahead. Yeah.
So I don't like the definition you've given us of a game of random chance, because I don't think there is any. So then
a professional gambler is relying on.
He's relying on his ability. He's relying on his abilities. There is no such thing as luck. I don't believe in that either.
I don't believe in luck.
I try to correct people with that on a regular basis.
Right.
The problem with something like poker is you win by erasing all of your tells and your ability to deceive the other person so that they think they've got something that is better than yours, and then they find out through the process of exchange of money.
Is that questionable? I guess to me that would be questionable. That's, I mean, true. I would be, you know.
I'm lying to you to see if I can get your money.
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
Yeehaw. Hey.
Wow. Yeah, what time is it?
It's 9:50, and I'm not sure where to go now. I'm up to my armpits in the mud, and I can't get out. Yeah, Rick, go ahead.
I go to the grocery store and seeing some poor kid put a quarter in a machine to get a doll or a present or such. That's a gambling machine. You're not guaranteed anything. He's putting his money in.
I don't know if that's, well, but now you're back to the risk thing, okay? I mean, if I buy, you know, if I buy stock in Ford, I'm not guaranteed anything. No, it's risking. I disagree because, you know, I disagree that it's gambling because, you know, I'm investing in the ownership of Ford Motor Company on the prospect that Ford Motor Company can produce automobiles at a profit, and I guess you could have a moral conversation about whether or not you should make a profit. I would just point out that in my wife's business, she is not a non-profit seamstress. And we make no bones about that and have never pretended anything other than that she runs a for-profit venture. So, okay. You know what? I'm not exactly sure how this will all translate. I'm not sure that we have another hour's worth of discussion, but we're obviously not finished here. So I give you a homework assignment. Give some thought and consideration to everything that's been said. Jot down some notes, and we're going to come back to this next week, and we'll see what happens. So.